Well, hello again, and welcome to this week's Guardian Tech Weekly podcast. Everything you ever wanted to know about technology, but were too socially awkward to ask. I'm Paul Carr, standing in again for Alex Krotowski, who's still, well, you know, not here. I'm joined live-ish in the studio by the charming Jemima Kish and the lovely Charles Arthur. And as ever, we have an energy-packed programme to make your commute-slash-gym-session-slash-jury-service pass at warp speed. Hello, Charles, and hello, Jemima.
Hello. Yes, hello.
Borderline scary. So, yeah. So Jemima, what have you been fiddling with this week?
Oh, all manner of gadgets. A flip minnow, new little flip thing. I managed to break one and then had to try another one.
How do you break a...
I pressed too many buttons at once.
You crashed it.
I crashed it.
It's idiot-proof.
And because it's got a built-in battery and you can't change the batteries and reset it or whatever, there was no way to... reboot it.
And Charles, what have you broken this week?
Well, I've been trying to break my Mac, but I installed Parallels Desktop for Mac and I installed VMware, and I think I'll set the two of them and tell each other they're both virtual machines and let them fight it out like killer robots.
Wow.
See which one comes out top.
Far too much time on your hands, Charles. Well, this week Bobby's been out and about meeting inventor and one-man patent machine, Dr. Saul Griffith, and Jemima and Charles went to find out what was what at the Guardian Hack Day. So it's going to be an epic show, so wherever you're listening to us, don't touch that iPod wheel thing. Bobby's still living the high life in San Francisco, where I gather this week the weather's been nothing short of astonishing. Still, he managed to take some time away from sunning himself and drinking smoothies to meet the Australian inventor Saul Griffith, who's the founder of more companies than most of us have had hot dinners, including low-cost eyeglasses, Squid Labs, Potenko, Indestructibles.com, Haltoons, and Makani Power. He started off by asking how an idea goes from being an idea to being something you can make.
I think inventors are inherently selfish.
In what sense?
In the sense you're like, oh, you know, I really wish I had a... dot dot dot, or I really wish I knew about XYZ. And then you go about finding it out or building it and making it for yourself. Sometimes you disguise that in very convoluted justifications that you're doing it for the world or doing it for other things, but I think very, very often you're trying to improve something in your life, and often enough you have a problem that a lot of other people have, so it turns out to be wildly useful. I've made an awful lot of things that are only good for me. Some of them I thought were going to be fantastic for everyone else, but I guess, you know.
I was talking to someone else and they were saying the number of projects they've worked on that they thought would be brilliant, you know.
Oh, every project I'm starting is going to be brilliant. And I probably start multiple projects a day. And I think you can pretty much tell how many things I do that are complete fuck-ups.
is there one that other people had to spend a lot of time convincing you wasn't useful for them?
Oh, most people know that it would just be like pushing shit uphill with a pointed stick as regards me, so they don't bother trying to convince me not to do something. Fortunately, I do things fast, so they're like, oh, well, if he does that, at least he'll be done with it next week.
Yeah.
But I don't know, a lot of that's just intellectual exercises, right? It's like practicing.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things. I mean, how much of it is... Part of it is, you know, maybe you've got a problem. But on the other hand, there's you know, just intellectual curiosity of, is it possible to do this?
And I think you have neatly defined, in less words than I would have, the two motivations for inventing something.
Hmm.
People try and glorify and understand invention and ascribe it to genius and all these things, and I think none of those things are true. It typically happens in the, oh, cool, wouldn't it be cool if I could tow a hydrofoil catamaran behind a kite? And you're like, yeah, that would be cool, I'll do that. And then while you're doing it, you try and justify why this is useful to the world. Or there's the, damn, my phone... I keep running out of charge and I'm nowhere near an outlet. I need a solution for that for me. Oh, actually, you know, when I think about it, probably a lot of other people have that problem. And you do that. And sometimes people come to you with, you know, here's this problem that I have or someone else has. Do you think you have a solution? And there's actually a lot of fun, and you do invent things out of it, around that. But I think that's probably a smaller portion.
I suppose it's the art of noticing what your problem is in the first place, isn't it? You know, people who aren't looking for the answers themselves maybe find it harder to realise this is a solvable problem in the first place.
You know, I think often invention is just play too, right? You don't just, you know, it's like, you don't wake up and say, oh, I don't have anything to invent today.
Mm.
I think if you wake up and you're like, I don't have anything to invent today, I'm at a loss, you're kind of screwed. If you wake up every day and say, like, oh, I'm just going to do cool things, or I'm going to go and find a new passion or a new hobby, right? As soon as you pick up and start doing anything, it'll make new connections and synapses fire, and you're like, oh, well, wouldn't it be cool if, and then you're there again.
Mm.
So I think the death of the inventor or the creative person is to sit around waiting for the idea. They always happen. If you're just actively engaged in the world and you find everything fascinating, kind of if you're unborable, you're in great shape. I think it was great when I went to MIT. I finally felt like I had siblings. No, I mean, no, my sister is awesome, but like, I finally felt like I had found my community. That's a more accurate thing.
Yeah.
And by community, I just mean obsessive, compulsive, crazy people who one day are fascinated about singing with diesel engines and the next day are fascinated about making blenders that are voice operated.
Mm.
And if you have a peer group who's just all of them are doing that type of stuff all the time, I don't know, life is grand. And you know, you're all cross fertilizing with each other and you're all rejoicing in each other's stupidity.
Yeah.
And it's awesome.
Well, you're not limited by, you know, the embarrassment factor is not there for a start.
No, because you've all built the thing that was horribly embarrassing and you proudly showed it to a friend who looked quizzically at you and then sort of raised their eyebrow, and then you finally realized that four sleepless nights you just spent were kind of, you know, they make you aware of why that was a bad idea. But it's sort of there's no shame in it because they've done it too, right?
Yeah.
And you've raised your eyebrow at their creations. And I think having that community is pretty special.
Bobby Johnson there talking to Dr. Saul Griffiths about the process of inventing. Now, inventing, have either of you guys...
James Dyson.
He's the name. I was just trying to think of inventors, and James Dyson, of course. But do we... There's so many things get invented, but we can't name more than like a couple of inventors. I mean, Trevor Bayliss, I think, is the other one.
Yeah, Trevor Bayliss, who has really revolutionised things. I think actually the whole clockwork radio, clockwork this, clockwork MP3 player sort of thing is
clockwork
an example
orange.
Of... yeah, that's right.
Famously.
But actually the thing that pulls out the inventors you've heard of from all the ones you don't is that they're really obsessive. It's not actually whether their invention is useful and clever, although, you know, in the cases of Dyson and Bayliss, you know, their things frequently are. But there's lots of people who have inventions that are useful and clever, but you never see them because you have to be obsessive about it. You have to spend hours and hours in your garden shed down the garden or whatever producing prototypes and making it even better. And then you have to go and find a company that will make it, which won't nick all your intellectual property, which means you have to find a patent lawyer. So you have to do it in a way the patent lawyer... And it's so expensive.
You sound like you've got form
consuming.
Here.
Yeah, Charles in his shed going, why am I underappreciated?
I wrote about precisely this topic for New Scientist 13 years ago. So, and you know, all the things that were true then are still absolutely true now.
Isn't it probably true, though, that the number of people that really come up with enormously radical, revolutionary ideas are few and far between, and that most developments are small sort of incremental improvements on an existing technology? So
very much so. I mean, but then, you know, you look at the Dyson vacuum cleaner, for example, which he's most famous for. He basically took an idea that he had seen, the industrial cyclone cleaner, which is used in great big buildings, and it's basically a way of getting all dust out of the thing, and he turned it into something for a vacuum cleaner you could use in your home. And
is that so?
I mean, people think that invention's easier now with the internet, but to some extent it's made a bit more difficult because there are so many incremental things happening all the time. You know, the biggest invention, so to speak, on the internet was probably, apart from the web itself, Google and the PageRank algorithm, the whole method of searching. But even that wasn't brand new. Other people had the same sort of idea, but Larry Page and Sergey Brin did it better than other people.
Mm. Well, and also, is there a question of a lot of the inventors are working within big companies? So even if there are these amazing inventions coming out, we don't tend to hear about them. For example, there's a lot comes out of Apple.
I've heard about Viagra.
Well, yeah, but could you tell me who invented it?
A team in Pfizer down in Surrey.
Yeah, but not exactly, and that's the point. So it's a question of, we know the company, perhaps, like we know, like Apple has innovated massively, but apart from Jonathan Ive and apart from Steve Jobs, who could you put your finger and say, this is the guy who invented X? This is the guy, and
the mad professor in Back to the Future.
Yes.
we can name
people?
A fictional inventor now.
Christopher Lloyd.
Yeah.
So right. So apart from Christopher Lloyd,
no, we can't name
our inventors are underappreciated.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, one final question, I guess. If you could invent your dream product, your dream thing, guys, what would you invent?
Well, this is a really simple thing, but stiletto shoes that have a very, very hard rubber heel, so that they don't make a clip-cloppy noise on the floor.
Oh. That's interesting.
And they big also Jemima.
No, but yeah. also they wow. wouldn't. They'd be very practical because they wouldn't Edison. Slip over. They wouldn't slip over on shiny floors.
Would they be slightly bendy as well? So you sort of walked with a wobble.
No, no, no. Just a tip.
Wow. Can't you just stick rubber on the bottom?
Yeah. Why don't you just make that, Jemima?
Very hard rubber.
No, but it would have to be a super dense, industrial, really strong rubber because normal plastic tips wear away really lightly. These kind of things change the world.
I've, you say, I've never seen
you. What world do they change exactly?
Yes. As for me, well, I think I'd like fusion reactor actually. Then we'd solve all the problems.
Two very diverse
views there on invention.
Possibly we can make the very hard rubber inside the fusion reactor and kill two birds with one stone.
And then Christopher Lloyd can take us all back to the future. Well, you can find out absolutely everything you could possibly want to know about Dr. Saul at www.saulgriffith.com. And while you're doing that, here's Jemima with the news.
Jerry Yang has finally stepped down as chief executive of Yahoo after months of speculation. He will resume his previous title of chief Yahoo and keep a board seat while headhunters search for his successor. We follow this closely on guardian.co.uk/technology. Sun Microsystems is to cut up to 6,000 jobs, 18% of its workforce, the firm said on Friday. Chief Executive Jonathan Swartz said the company had to take decisive action to align its business with global economic realities, signifying the biggest hit so far for Silicon Valley. Malicious software attacks could peak on Monday the 24th of November, researchers are warning. Internet users shopping online are top targets for criminals, particularly before the Thanksgiving break in the US. Google is expected to release a voice recognition app for the iPhone this week, ahead of a version for its own Android mobile operating software. The software lets users ask questions rather than typing them into a phone, though Google is playing catch-up with existing services from Yahoo and Microsoft. US President-elect Barack Obama might have victoriously tweeted from his smartphone during election night, but he'll almost certainly be ditching the BlackBerry when he takes office. Thanks to a combination of the risk of hackers and regulation that means all correspondence must be open to the public, Obama won't be emailing at all. The lucky, lucky man.
Well, thank you, Jemima. And so everyone's getting fired from Sun and from everywhere.
Well, not everyone, but, you know, 18%, that's, I think it's between 5,000 and 6,000 people. That's a big whack of jobs at a very big influential firm, obviously. So it's a bit of a bellwether.
And this is just the beginning, isn't it? This is like, because we've seen a few sort of dribs of redundancies, because so Wired.com have laid off.
Yeah, on the editorial side, Gawker as well.
They've got all the value whack. It's just Owen now sitting
swallowed.
Yeah.
It's because I wrote a column last week basically saying London needs its own valleywag, and now, of course, so does San Francisco.
Well,
so,
yes.
Apparently I'm cursed before we even start. And then, yeah, and Six Apart have laid off. They're now just five apart, I think. Sorry. Yeah, are we going to see everyone
more
in tech being laid off?
Yeah, it's doom.
Fewer people doing the podcast.
Sun, though, doesn't seem to be able to get into an upward spiral. Sun is always going into a downward spiral. It's sort of laying people off saying, well, we're cutting the prices of everything and giving our software away. That's great news. And everyone goes, well, if you want the software for free and the hardware cheaper, yes. Not sure how it works for you for the money thing. I mean, you know, Sun is now worth a market value of $4, gives it a market value of $3 billion, which means Apple could buy it many, many times over. In fact, Apple has enough money sitting in the bank at the moment to buy both Dell and Sun outright and still have a few hundred million left over.
Which is nice.
Which is nice. Maybe Dell computers would look less like bricks and more like cute things.
Could we make a really bad taste sweepstake about where the next kind of batch of redundancies might be?
I give Owen Thomas at ValueWag about another 6 months. So I'm having him.
He's the only one that's hanging on in there.
I know, that's
what
I mean. That's going to be shuttered by middle of next year. There's no way. Especially roll it into Gawker. Gawker's going to hate it. Like, the Gawker readers are going to hate all the tech.
I never read Gawker. I don't understand why they're doing it. It's nuts.
So talk to us about voice over IP or whatever it is. Voice activation, this nonsense.
Well, I was at the Future Mobile conference this week, and I did a little bit of a rant saying that, you know, things still aren't really working that well. And if you want to do any decent level of data inputting, whether that's email or, you know, using a blogging app or something, it's really bloody hard to do because you've got a fiddly little keyboard or a fiddly little keypad or, you know, whatever your phone has. And voice recognition technology might be an answer to that. I don't expect it to be the complete answer, but depending how reliable it is, and obviously that's a kind of big if, really, it could really be bloody useful. Mm. And this is an app that is designed to help you search for kind of films and, I think restaurants and stuff. So it ties in with Google Maps. It's interesting that they're releasing this version for the iPhone.
Yeah.
and not for Google's own Android.
That is a bit odd. So it's a good idea, but it's badly executed.
I don't think that. I think what they're probably thinking is that the kind of people that have iPhones are much more likely to fiddle with the app and give it a good road test. That's what they're thinking. So it's quite canny, but I just want it. I'm willing it to be good.
Yeah.
I think they told Barack Obama he couldn't have a BlackBerry or other sort of mobile device because they were scared that he'd use this thing and say, okay, should I bomb Iran or not? Yeah. Make the decisions for me, Google.
Do you feel lucky? Yeah. And as you already well know, you can read about all of these stories and so many, many, many more at guardian.co.uk/technology. Now then, on Friday, Jemima and Charles packed up their laptop bags and went all the way across the road to the Guardian's Hack Day. Jemima, what in the name of God is a hack day?
Oh, come on, you know what a hack day is.
Please.
Lots of developers get the day off their normal work and they get given lots of sets of data and kind of back doors to content they're not normally allowed to play with, and they can just go and build cool stuff with it, basically, for 24 hours, and then...
No one sleeps. It's like driving
Nobody
to Daytona
sleeps.
Or something.
Lots of pizza.
Or Le Mans, actually.
Oh,
yes,
yeah, Le Mans.
It's the Le Mans race for hacks.
They get 24 hours, and then at the end of that, they have to do a 60-second, and it can only be 60-second, presentation of what they've done, and the best one gets a prize.
Well, let's hear how it all went down.
Hi, I'm Matthew Somerville. I'm a web developer working for my site at the moment.
The excellent My Society. Okay, so you've been doing a couple of different hacks today, but what's charlian.co.uk?
It's a version of the Guardian website that uses their RSS feeds and so on to give you the only necessary bit of the Guardian, really, when you get down to it, which is everything to do with Charlie Brooker.
Okay, so we're looking at a very impressive brand new feel to The Guardian, which says charlian.co.uk at the top, and every single story and every single pixie, which are the little graphics down the side of the page, is everything Charlie Brooker's ever done. Have you told Charlie Brooker about this?
I don't know him, but I'm sure he'll probably hear about it and probably won't like it.
Are you going to win?
No, I don't think so, no.
My name is Ken Lim, and I work at The Guardian as a web developer. The Guardian has actually been studiously putting keywords on all our articles for quite a long time now. And it's become a little bit of a sport called Guardian whacking, where you can take two keywords that may or may not be obviously related to see what articles actually match, have those two keywords stuck inside them. What I decided to do was to make it very easy by making the keywords suddenly come alive so that you could just pick them up off the page itself and drop them on another keyword so they would just merge together into this combination that would suddenly just give you the appropriate page.
So that's really clever. So the demonstration you've just done in front of us now was that you dragged a keyword from the side of the page, which was Middle East, onto the money tab in the navigation bar so that we've now created a specialist aggregated page, if you like, of all the stories that are related to money and the Middle East.
Yes.
Very clever.
Thank you.
I'm Ben Griffiths, and I hacked something so that when you look at big numbers on the Guardian website, £50 million for this, £500 billion for that, you can see those numbers in terms of equivalent. So £50 million will buy you two schools, and £200 billion may buy you 400 billion whisper bars and so on. And it's a way of making the big numbers, which come at us all the time, especially during the credit crunch and all these reconstructions and bailouts and so on, it's making those a little bit more understandable for people.
And describe how that actually appeared to us on the screen, because it was quite small, manageable, and you had, say, 10 different options, didn't you, including Ross Money.
Yes, so on the screen there's a little menu which shows you the different units you can use. So if you click on teachers, it will show you the number of teachers' salaries right next to the number in the article. So whereas the article might have said Bank of Scotland has been given £300 billion by the government, it will now say the Bank of Scotland has been given £300 billion, and in brackets, enough for however many teachers' schools that buys, and so on and so forth. It's a way of kind of subverting some of the context of the story so that stories about financial things can then become stories about education, and stories about celebrities can be stories about financial things and so on.
We'll see how some of those interesting ideas did later on. But next I stumbled on Simon Willison, our technical architect with the Guardian Developer Network. It's early days for the network, and this Hack Day was its first semi-public outing. More news on that in the next few months, so watch this space. Anyway, as part of this event, they'd acquired a load of government data to work with, so I asked Simon what data he'd got and what he was doing with it.
I played around with a whole bunch of different things, MOD, defence budget breakdowns, all of that kind of thing. But I ended up getting interested in the electoral data about parliamentary constituencies, mainly because I thought it would look really good on a map. And so I spent most of my time over Hack Day trying to find maps of electoral of parliamentary constituencies that I could use, and then sort of munging the data into a state where it could actually be presented, which took far longer than I ever thought it would.
So this is just one example of the kind of the sort of online infographic, if you like, that can be done with this kind of data. But it seems like there's almost unlimited potential for The Guardian to be doing much more database journalism, if you like. I mean, do we need to sort of change our editorial processes a bit, maybe, so that this becomes a more staple part of what we do? Because it's incredibly, incredibly powerful.
It is. It's incredibly powerful, and The Guardian is really well positioned to do stuff like this. We actually collect huge amounts of information already. We put it together, we put it into infographics, but so far there hasn't been so much work done in actually taking that over to the websites and doing stuff with it there.
And so to the winners. There was a lot of high praise from the judges for all of their efforts, but the overall winner was Ken Lim, who we heard from earlier, with his hack that makes use of Guardian tags. So he seemed the ideal person to ask, what makes a good hack?
Well, if you look at the dictionary definition of a hack, it really is a shortcut to making something happen. So what the end result really has to be something that's obvious, something that's very useful, and overall something that, although might be a little bit budgy in appearance, but is kind of elegant in its solution.
Sort of something that you'd like to be there, but which isn't there.
Yes, something that isn't there, but that you know that you can just make it happen if you just did a little bit extra, or if you just wired something from point A to point B. Yeah.
And also, I guess, that once you see it there, once it's sort of demonstrated, it's obvious.
Yes, exactly. It has to bring value, or else it's just a curiosity.
After it was all over and the equipment was being packed away and the beers were being opened in the background, I cornered Mac McAllister, the former head of the Yahoo developer network, who's now head of the Guardian's developer network, to ask him how the day had been for him.
It was amazing. There were the breadth of the different types of hacks, and the fact that people were using content in different and interesting ways was particularly compelling.
What did you like best?
Yeah, it's a tough question. I just love seeing all the creativity from the various perspectives that people bring. You know, you've got back-end people doing some kind of front-end work, and you've got front-end work being done with journalists, and there's a great kind of mix of talents all coming together for these really creative ideas that are done in a really short amount of time.
It's quite an incredible feat to squeeze this all into the 24 hours.
It is. It's hard work. And, you know, some of these guys stayed up all night. There were at least a handful of people who slept over in the Guardian offices. And there were people working until 4 a.m. And then when they showed up in the morning, you'd try and ask them questions or try and get a demo of their hack. And they were too busy. They wanted to get to work at, you know, at 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning. They didn't want to talk. They wanted to get to work and finish their hack.
So will there be another one?
Yeah, definitely. We'll do more of these for sure.
So that was Charles and Jemima there at the Guardian's Hack Day. So Jemima, why was the Guardian doing a Hack Day?
Well, I think people don't really realise quite how many developers we've got here. And we had an absolutely enormous team of developers, well over 100 people working on R2, which is the huge, big, very clever content management system that our website runs on.
R2.
As in version 2.
Oh, okay, not yes. Like as an R2-D2.
No.
That would be cool.
Well, if we get yeah. D2 as well, then, you know, obviously yeah, everyone will hear about
D2 obviously will be coming some way down the line. But at its peak, there were 75 developers in the office for the Hack Day. And they're incredibly creative people. And I think the idea was just to try and bring editorial and technical a bit closer. Hack Days have been going on for years. I think the first
Facebook
one was at Yahoo. Yeah, Facebook does them. Google, and, you know, they're a standard kind of thing in technology land now.
You know what you should do?
But I think it's very rare to have the valuable kind of content that we have on the Guardian website to play with.
Well, Facebook, apparently, whenever anyone apart from Zuckerberg can at any point decide they're going to have a Hack Day. And so just now.
You mean Zuckerberg can't?
Zuckerberg's not allowed to. Because he's the boss. So it's like, obviously, whatever he says, they have to do anyway. So it's not quite as much fun if he does it. It just becomes a job. But anyone else who works at Facebook apparently is like, this was in Sarah Lacey's book, where they can basically say, oh, let's have a hack day. And so it's 24 hours. They get pizza and Red Bull, the finest.
Such a cliche.
Pizza and Red Bull in all the land. And they're all allowed to take a day off work the following day to recover from the pizza and the Red Bull. So maybe that's what the Guardian should start.
I think we need like the editorial equivalent of Hack Day. So we get together and we just come up with really bloody good ideas and then spend all night researching them.
And there's no paper the following day because it's just ideas.
We work online, Paul.
Of course, of course.
Yes. No, but it's brilliant. It's incredibly creative. And I think a lot of people who don't really understand how the technology side of things works, you know, a lot of people that came down from editorial were really excited by what they saw. It's great.
Well, if you'd like to be excited about what you see, you can find more about the Hack Day on Jemima's PDA blog, which is at guardian.co.uk/media/PDA. And so now to my very, very, very favourite part of the podcast, where we take a look at The Guardian's various technology-related blogs, and I pretend to care about the comments that have been posted there. No, I'm kidding. You people are great. So, Jemima, what have you found this week?
Oh, you know, well, I couldn't help myself but post Puppy Cam, because it was brilliant.
You're the girliest person in the room, aren't you?
I might be in this room, but I'm generally not that girly.
Just shoes and puppies.
For those of you who have not experienced Puppy Cam, they're six... shut up. Six Shiba Inu puppies who are some kind of cutesy California breed. And just a live webcam on them. And I hate to admit it, but yes, they were quite cute.
Do you have to pay to see these
puppies? No, it's totally free. It's on Ustream.
Were they being threatened by the fires? That'd be interesting, wouldn't it?
Because I signed up to recycle puppy cam once and it cost me $12 a month.
Different types of puppies, yeah. Anyway, somebody said... I'd introduced it by saying, well, remember justin.tv, and then that all turned out to just be a gimmick for selling live streaming, as they called it. Anyway, someone said, what genius PR agency does Justin.tv use? And then, what crappy journalism school produces journalists that recycle such tat? Fortunately, a whole stream of people jumped in afterwards saying, oh, it's the internet and it's puppies in a box, so it's shut up and you old curmudgeon, and lots of other comments. And then Rottweil Steve said that he ran Rotty Vision for 2 years.
I have contempt for these people, sorry.
Shut it. These are our readers and we love them all.
Yes, indeed.
Surely they should feed the puppies of the Rottweilers, wouldn't they? I mean,
oh, I'd watch that. That'd be great.
And so the stream continued to go downhill in a similar, similar vein.
I'm going to talk about... I saw another lifecasting thing. iJustine. To those of you who don't know, she's this sort of Uber video lifecaster called Justine.
Is she the kind of girl you crack onto and fail?
Do you know what? A friend of mine who shall go remain nameless, a dot-com
Robert
entrepreneur...
Locke.
No, not Robert Locke, although he'll love the name check. No... actually saw her at... actually, I'll have to tell you who it is because he wasn't really cracking onto her, but it's quite important for the story. Michael Smith from Mind Candy met her at South by Southwest and she said, so what do you do? And he said, oh, I run a company called Mind Candy, to which she screamed, oh my God, I love candy. So Michael had to pretend for the rest of the conversation that it was some sort of candy-related startup.
Well, he would be much cooler if he did run a sweet shop.
I would. I'd love Michael in a sweet shop. I'd love
make
to see
money
that.
Make more money?
But anyway, this Justine woman is doing... she's just made a video commercial for an online backup company called Mosey. Jack was very interested in this, but the fact they were giving away these T-shirts, which say on them, back the F... /up.
Oh, like your F drive.
There you go.
See what they did,
clever.
Brilliant.
But Jack's got very excited and annoyed about the fact that they spell on their all their press release and everything, they spell T-shirt with a lowercase T. And as he says, it's T uppercase shirt, not T lowercase shirt. You see, because it's a shirt that's shaped like a T. It's not shaped like a lowercase T. It's just wrong. It's like as if you wrote a T in lowercase junction or an A in lowercase line dress. So, yeah, he's gone insane. But fortunately, you can always rely on somebody else to be more insane. Because at least he's being paid to be insane. Whereas a commenter, Slabman, comes in to say, I often wear T-shirts shaped like a lowercase T. I have bad posture. I'm disappointed in Jack's desire to wear this T-shirt, though. Until today, I didn't realise he had a torso. I'm not sure my mind can adjust this new concept.
Hang on, how can he wear a T-shirt that's like a lowercase T? Unless he's only got one arm.
Yeah, one arm.
Or else he's sort of very endowed.
And down.
Or else he's very endowed in the man boobs.
I suspect what we're doing here is seeing Slabman's legendary comedy genius at play.
Yeah. Yes. Or being ripped apart.
And you can see more
Jonglers
of Slabman. Charles, help us forget that.
Jack did a post about the Sun layoffs, and he pointed to ponytailed Sun boss Jonathan Schwartz, a.k.a. My Little Pony, which is what Dan Lyons, a.k.a. Fake Steve Jobs, would always call him, hasn't yet commented on his blog, but on November 10 commented about the whole idea. Imagine Jonathan Schwartz saying, I can't remember a single customer upset at the idea of paying $20,000 for computing infrastructure used to cost them $100,000. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So that's the blog post, to which Jack says, yes, unless it kills you.
And of course, you can find links to all of the tech, digital content and games blogs at guardian.co.uk/techweekly, where you'll also find links to our Facebook group, Twitter, Flickr, and all that nonsense. Charles, we're all on Twitter, but you've been looking at the stars. What's going on?
I thought I had my own, not quite a hack day, but more of a sort of a hack half an hour. I'm very entertained by the idea of the Mars Phoenix lander, which early this year blomped down on Mars and has been digging for victory.
Sorry, blomped?
Yes, that's the technical term.
Okay, you're the expert.
Looking for water, looking for all sorts of things. And I rather like the idea that it was just gradually winding down, yeah, rather like HAL in the film 2001, where it's sort of just generally losing it. And so I ran some of the Mars Phoenix tweets through a program which is built into Apple's operating system where you can turn text into speech. And then I ran it through another program which will speed them up or slow them down, depending. To give you an idea of, you know, how Mars Phoenix went from being this happy-go-lucky machine just arrived on Mars to its last minutes.
6 a.m. May 26th.
Atmospheric entry has started. Time to get really nervous. Now I'm in the 7 minutes of terror.
The 7 minutes of terror being the fear it's going to burn up.
2:55 a.m. May 26th.
I'm sitting on very flat surface here. Tiny rocks around my footpads. The horizon is flat and looks perfect for digging.
Around my footpads?
It's like haiku.
It's like footpads, yeah. We got Stephen Hawking, obviously, to tell us the times of the tweets.
It's incredibly cruel to put Stephen Hawking on Mars. It's not very nice at all.
Well, this is his nurse, I think, on Mars. Yeah.
6:30 p.m. November 9th.
It's very unlikely I'll wake up next spring. But if I do, I'll call home.
That's heartbreaking.
And then the last one, which is...
Beautiful, Stephanie.
Which is the binary version of triumph, apparently.
9:12 p.m. November 10th.
0101010.
Well, that was heartbreaking, but moving and just delightful. Thanks, Charles.
Swiping a digital tear from my eye.
0100.
Nothing moves me like Twitter, obviously.
In Thursday's Guardian Tech section, Ordnance Surveys put its minister, Ian Wright, on a collision course with Home Secretary Jackie Smith and other powerful ministers. The US has told local authorities they shouldn't be reusing their data on Google Maps, which means no mapping of crime, public toilets or recycling. Why is the US provoking a showdown, and can it win? We ask if after Jerry Yang, son's Jonathan Schwartz is next for the chop. We look at the Australian government's moves to press ahead with internet filtering. And what's the deal with games engines? Suddenly the way to make your game popular is to encourage people to write modifications for them. This and more in Thursday's tech section with The Guardian.
Well, that's all we've got time for yet another week. I'll be back next week for one last guest hosting gig, and then you can all have Alex back. You'll be delighted to hear.
Oh, you're going to free her from where you've been holding her hostage.
She's locked in my basement.
Like that storyline in Corrie, yeah.
I'll have to take your word for that. Well, I was going to ask what you've got in store for you this week, Charles, but clearly watching Corrie. Anything else?
Watching The Wire. I've got a killer robot, which I've been lent, so I'll have to see if I can set that on the dog and which one wins.
Oh, can you put it on a webcam so I can watch it?
Possibly. Yes.
CharlesIsKillerRobot.org.
Hmm.
Jemima?
Me?
Any plans to kill anything with robots?
I don't really watch TV. I don't really have any robots either. Sorry about that.
What sort of life do you have?
I know. I got a couple of...
No killer robots,
no TVs.
How
do you get out of bed in the morning?
Sorry. I've got a couple of interviews lined up.
Anyone that you can
One with
talk
YouTube on? And one about genealogy, which is quite interesting. So I'm working on those in the next week and loads of other stuff. Just, I mean, you know, we'd have to do a whole other podcast just to talk about the amount of stuff that's coming up in the next week.
Well, maybe I can ask you about it this time next week when we have a whole other podcast.
What, when we've done it?
Yeah, once it's all done.
Yeah.
Splendid. Well, all that remains for me to do is to thank Jemima, Charles and Bobby, as well as Saul Griffiths and all the people who made the Guardian Hack Day such a roaring success.
And thanks for listening, and I'll see you next Tuesday.